Hi, this is Angus King. Welcome to Inside Maine. Today, we're talking about congressionally directed spending, some projects here in Maine, and what they mean to the people of their communities. Congressional directed spending is a new term, and it's what used to be called earmarks. And in the bad old days, earmarks were snuck into the budget by certain members of Congress. Nobody knew where they came from, what they were for, what the justification was, and it really wasn't a really good process. They were eliminated about 15 years ago, and then 3 or 4 years ago, brought back, but in a new form. Number one, limited to 1% of the total budget. Number two, the members of Congress have to submit these projects very publicly. They go before the Appropriations Committee publicly, and after the awards are made by the Appropriations Committee and ultimately by the entire budget, then all the projects are public. Everybody has to be accountable for them. So it's a really different process, and I like it because it lets our congressional delegation make decisions about what the priority should be here in Maine, rather than somebody in Washington who may or may not know the difference between Presque Isle and Kittery. So it's a locally driven process. And by the way, the only eligible applicants are nonprofits and public entities, the state or local government. No for-profit entities are involved in this process. So we've just had the final awards for this past year when the budget passed a month or so ago, and we're going to talk to a couple of people today who are engaged in this process to tell us about their projects and how this is working for them. My first guest is Tony Ronzio. Tony is a former newspaper editor. He's been around Maine for a long time, and Tony is now with the Governor's Office of Innovation and the Future, which Tony sounds suspiciously like to me, like the old State Planning Office. So Tony, tell me about the Office of Innovation and what the mission is, and then we'll talk about this particular CDS project.
Absolutely, Senator, and it's really great to join you today to talk about these wonderful projects, and thank you to you and your office for helping get some of the funding over the finish line for some of the work that we're doing. So the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation in the Future was created by Governor Mills back in 2019. You know, we are, a forward-looking version of what the old State Planning Office was. We do a lot of outreach with communities. We do a lot of long-range plans on critical issues facing the state. And we, you know, focus on trying to bring as many stakeholders and as many state agencies, as many collaborators together so we can talk about what can we do, not for necessarily tomorrow, but for the long-range viability of our state. One of the things I like to think about is that we plant a lot of trees under which the shade we will never sit, so we can be able to have some long-range progress on many of the issues facing our state. And one of the big issues that we talk about is climate change, right? Climate change is affecting areas of our state across from Aroostook County down to York County in a variety of different ways, and we bring a lot of groups together to support local community planning, local community action on climate and energy issues, and that has become so critical, especially over the storms and a lot of the storm damage we saw in December and January. So, our office is very busy. The future is a little hazy, but we are engaged to make the best of it for the people of Maine.
Well, you talk about the storms and climate change. I had an interesting discussion. I was at an ice fishing derby in southern Maine a couple of months ago and talked to a fellow who was a forester. He was a logger, and he'd worked in the woods in Maine and New Hampshire and northern Massachusetts for many years. And I said, what do you see in terms of climate change? Do you see any differences? He said, oh yeah. He said, the first thing I've noticed is the bugs, the insects. There are different insects now heading north that we've never seen before in Maine. And it's one of the things that we have to be concerned about. But what I noticed was the people who work on the water, on the land, are the ones who really see climate change firsthand, and they know that it's happening and that we've got to do something about it, which brings us to the project. Describe this, the project, the CDS grant that the state has taken, and I understand is mostly going to flow through to various communities.
That's right. And you're exactly right. You know, those on, you know, those in our heritage industries, those on the water, those in the forest, those, you know, our farmers are seeing the impact of the long-term trends. And then you have wake-up calls like the storms of December and January that show how the severity of climate impacts are going to be impacting our state for years to come. So the program that we launched, you know, using the funding from your office, it's called the Rural Energy Resilience Pilot Program. And it is a direct outcome of our office's work with a lot of rural communities around this big idea of climate and energy resilience, right? And what does that mean exactly? It means developing energy systems for rural communities to make sure that if the power goes out due in an extreme storm, or if something happens in that community where they need to stand up a shelter to deal with extreme heat or extreme cold, the energy is there for that community to make sure that they're able to respond. So using $2.5 million through the CDS request to your office, we're going to work with 10 communities around the state to stand up solar energy and battery storage systems in public buildings in their communities. And I want to make sure I read off the specific communities so your listeners know exactly where this money is going. So it's going to Caribou, Carthage, Dover Foxcroft, Fairfield, Jonesport, Limestone, Lubeck, Machias, Millinocket, and Rockland.
So smaller towns and some very small towns. Carthage and Lubeck certainly qualify in the very small town. And the idea is to provide a constant source of energy for municipal facilities so that they can be a hub in case of an emergency. Is that the concept? That's what Bill Kitchen over in Machias has said about this.
That's exactly right. I mean, Machias is a great example. They were heavily impacted by the storms in January. And, you know, in smaller communities, your municipal buildings are the hub for a whole host of emergency response. In an extreme situation, they need to have power. They need to be up to support local emergency responders, ambulance services, EMS, you know, all the things that are necessary in an emergency, and having a reliable energy system is critically important. And if we are going to experience these extreme storms more often, which every scientist that works with us says is going to be the case, you need to have some systems in place to be resilient to those impacts. But there's other more day-to-day advantages as well. Like one of my favorite examples, Senator, is Dover Foxcroft, where their local community has taken a look at their public buildings as a resource for seniors. When if you have extreme high heat days and you have seniors that are living in places without air conditioning, you know, they've installed heat pumps in some public buildings to make sure that there's a cooling center for people to go, right? That relies on a reliable energy source as well. There's a daycare center in Dover Foxcroft at one of their public buildings for children, right? So again, having all of this resilient energy infrastructure pays dividends, not only in the extreme storms, but also in the day-to-day when dealing with some of these climate effects. Well, not to mention stabilizing energy costs and reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, I like the resilient idea, because our traditional approach to disasters in this country is we have the storm, we have the flood, we have the earthquake, and then we pay for the cleanup and the problem. We very rarely spend any money preventing that impact. We can't prevent the storm, but we can minimize the impact. Marco Rubio, my friend from Florida, and I are working on a bill to sort of reverse the Stafford Act in the sense of providing resiliency funds to prevent a catastrophic breakdown of a seawall, for example, or a washout of a road, which is often cheaper than rebuilding after the storm. So I think the key word here is resiliency, because we're just putting a bag over our heads if we don't know these storms are going to keep coming.
And we have so much incredible science and so much incredible information and data that are just showing what we should expect. Our climate council that our office works with has encouraged communities to plan for between 4 and 8 feet of sea level rise over the rest of the century. And so how are we going to build the resilient infrastructure and the resiliency into our communities to deal with that if we know and should plan for that, for what is coming? And so I completely agree with you. Like, why, you know, rebuilding is one thing, but that resiliency and recovery is crucially important. And that's what this program is really meant to do, specifically on the energy side.
Well, one thing I want to be sure and mention is that these projects are a team effort by the Maine delegation. Susan Collins, of course, is the vice chair of the Appropriations Committee. That doesn't hurt. And she does very well for us. She and I work together on most of the applications. We have separate ones, and Jared and Shelley do as well. But this is not, I mean, I'd like to take credit for all of this, but I can't. Because it really is a joint effort. Tony, do you see the towns, these small towns like Dover, Foxcroft, or Machias or Lubeck, do you have to persuade them that this is something they need to do, or are they anxious to get going?
I think anxious to get going, I think is a good way to describe it. I think seeing the urgency in the need to plan for what's coming is really the driving force here. So this particular pilot program that we're going to be doing with these 10 towns, it's a part of a larger initiative for our office called the Community Resilience Partnership that works with communities all around the state to help with planning for climate effects, help provide grant funding for certain actions, helps facilitate access to other federal funding for climate resilience. And we started that program, it kind of kicked off in earnest with Governor Mills in late 2021, early 2022. And we had a goal for our first year of getting to 100 communities working in this partnership. And I'm really happy to say by April of this year, we now have 226.
Wow.
It's not been a hard sell to say, a little bit of that planning in advance, a little of that prevention, helping small communities with the gap analysis and kind of like understanding where their vulnerabilities are and what we can do to address them. It's a winning proposition, especially when you see what's happened in December and January, which had such huge disproportionate impacts on rural areas, both inland and along the coast.
Well, those storms, those wind and tides in January were unbelievable. I mean, we had two storms that the strongest I've ever seen within 3 days. Normal high tide along the coast down in mid-coast where I live is about 8 feet. It was 14 feet that weekend. And of course, the wind was blowing, pushing the waves in. So I meet every day, practically meet somebody. They lost, a fisherman lost the dock, or they lost their bait house, or it's been hugely problematic. And of course, there are other programs, FEMA and other programs for helping out. And you mentioned solar. I think it's important. Just yesterday, I was looking at a chart of the cost of generating electricity by source, natural gas and coal and oil and, all the other possibilities. Solar is dead cheapest. Solar is the cheapest of any of those forms of energy. Now, if you put a battery pack in, that adds to a cost, of course, but we're really talking about in the long term saving these communities money for their taxpayers.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's beyond just cost savings, it's cost stability, right? Because all of those other sources of generation, especially those like natural gas, right, are subject to the same kind of like extreme price volatility that we've seen over the last couple of years, where global markets, global fossil fuel markets, they rise and they fall, and there's not price predictability. And what we saw with Russia-Ukraine over the last couple of years is just extreme price spikes that were out of anybody's control. And so, more than, half of the electricity in Maine is reliant on natural gas, right? Maine and New England. And so the more you can sort of diversify the energy mix, increase that stability, and as you have stability, you can drive those prices down. That's the kind of way to get to both energy independence, but also, reducing costs for taxpayers and reducing costs for businesses and ratepayers.
Well, tell me what other areas that your office is looking at beyond this project that we're talking about. It should be emphasized, these are pilot projects to see if this is going to work. And it's in a variety of different settings around the state, principally rural towns. But what are some other things? Are you guys looking at things like housing? And because that's certainly a, a, a looming problem for us. It's not looming, it's here.
It's here, yeah. I mean, as our office has worked and expanded, we've taken on a lot of different areas. Housing is a big one, and working across entities like Maine Housing, working with local communities, working with the legislature, working with stakeholders, trying to figure out how to increase housing supply in the state, and trying to figure out, you know, the right calibration for land use rules and all the rest of it to make sure that we can, you know, make a dent in. I think one of the issues in the state that's going to be how we address it is going to be really definitive in both our sort of our communities and also our economy going forward. So our office worked with Maine Housing and the Department of Economic and Community Development, which is sitting right behind me here, on a major report last year that talked about, you know, where Maine's housing stock over the last 10 years, where we, you know, how short we were. And kind of what kind of housing we need going forward. And it comes to one simple answer. We need to build more housing and find more ways to increase the housing stock in this state.
Find ways to build more housing cheaper. We're still building houses the way they built them 400 years ago. Mm-hmm. If Ford were built with a bunch of guys in a room nailing stuff together, it would cost $1 million. I mean, we've got to be thinking about modularization and the 3D printing up at the university and those kinds of things. I'll tell you, every business, main business that comes to my office or I see up here, interestingly, housing and workforce are their two big issues, and they're tied together because they can't bring new people in that they need if they can't find a place to live.
You can't have one without the other. And there are no bad ideas when it comes to housing and workforce for what we need to do to kind of address this in the state. Like, we know that we have a huge housing supply issue that we need to address. And we know we have, challenging demographic trends that are going to impact our workforce over the rest of the decade. And so they are deeply, deeply connected. One of my favorite programs that we've worked on, it's not even building housing or anything, but we've done a workforce transportation program where we've invested and partnered with private businesses and through the Department of Transportation to find solutions to move people in our state to where from population centers to where jobs are necessary. And we work with folks like BIW and just announced this week some grants that included efforts to get workers down to the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard in Kittery. And, you know, those are the kinds of solutions where as we figure out ways to build more housing and figure out ways to train and attract the workforce that we need, there's little pockets of innovation every single day where we can figure out ways to bridge some gaps.
Well, and part of that, I don't want to go too far astray from the congressionally directed spending, but the other piece is childcare. We're now realizing that, again, the underlying, one of the most fundamental problems in the Maine economy now is inadequate workforce. We don't have enough people to fill the jobs. And yet, if you are a single mom with two children, you can't go to work unless you can find childcare. So I think that's the other thing that we need to be working on is that's part of the infrastructure of working in this day and age that we also have to work on. Well, Tony, let's go back to the project. The other thing I like about these CDS projects is that often this is money that there wouldn't be another source for. In other words, it catalyzes activity like in these 10 towns that you're working with that otherwise wouldn't have anywhere else to go for this money. Is that your observation?
I think so. And this is where these funds can help bring forward some really innovative pilot programs like this one that would otherwise fall outside some of the funding sources that we would have to support communities. So, for example, the larger program that we have, the Resilience Partnership, that works with 226 communities around the state right now, offers grants of up to $50,000 for each community, right, for a very variety of projects. And they can use that for, you know, a variety of means. But to do something like this for a solar and storage investment, really to kind of pursue this energy resilience path, you know, we're looking at projects that are going to be between $125,000 and $250,000 per community, right? So far outside what our existing program can do, but these funds can help really catalyze what is possible for some of these small towns. And then if we have some real successful pilots and some good case studies, now we can go back and say, well, how do we scale this out to more communities to build upon the success with a different funding source?
Well, that's the idea. That's why I like this project so much. And I'm delighted we were able to get it through in the budget last year. I should mention to our listeners that if you want to know more about these projects, on my official website, which is king.senate.gov, my staff has created a wonderful interactive link where you can click on any county and then see and the individual projects in each county and what they are. There are 185 projects in total throughout the state, totaling about $485 million. And if you want to know where these projects are, what they're for, that's the place you can go and look. So, Tony, congratulations on putting together a good proposal. And I really will look forward to the results of these pilots. It could be a real breakthrough for Maine towns. And as you said, you'll have case studies and hopefully success stories that will motivate other towns to move in the same direction. So, Tony, thank you very much. Give my best to Hannah and the governor. And thanks for the work that you're doing.
Senator, thank you. It's been a pleasure to join you.
Always. We've just been with Tony Ronzio, who's one of the directors of the State Office of Innovation and the Future, and talking about a CDS project that they're undertaking as a kind of partnership with 10 small Maine towns on energy resiliency in the face of climate change. We're going to be right back and talk about what a different kind of project in Aroostook County and the difference that's going to make for young people up in the county going into the future. So stay with us. This is Angus King. You're with us on Inside Maine. Welcome back to Inside Maine. This is Angus King, and today we're talking about something called congressionally directed spending, which are grant program where the Congress decides on particular projects that would be useful and important in their states. The process just wound up for this past year when the budget passed several months ago, and we're talking to people in Maine who applied for and got one of these grants and are using it for the benefit of their community. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program is limited to 1% of the federal budget, has to be supported by the congressional delegation, only goes for nonprofits and governmental entities. And so that's how this system works. And it's all public. As I mentioned, you can go to my website, king.senate.gov, and see all the projects and have an idea of what it is that we're talking about here. Now I want to talk to Blake Hatt. And Blake is the chief operating officer of Northern Lighthouse. Not Northern Light, that's the healthcare people. Northern Lighthouse in Aroostook County, which is a program that deals with at-risk and behavioral health issues with kids. Blake, thanks for joining us. Tell us first about Northern Lighthouse.
Well, first, thank you very much for the opportunity to come in and speak with you today. We're really excited that we were able to work with you on this project. The Northern Lighthouse is a nonprofit mental health organization. We were established in 2001. Originally, we were providing residential treatment services for youth, and we've expanded over the years to outpatient therapy services, case management services for children and adults. And what brought us here today was our new project that we started back in 2022, which was we opened a emergency shelter for homeless youth, and then soon after a transitional living program for homeless youth. So we're really excited to talk about that today.
Well, Blake, this is a hard subject to talk about, and it's not something we even like to think about, but tell me about the situation of homeless young people in Aroostook County, as well as across the state. But this is something a lot of people don't know about. Is this an old problem, a relatively new problem? Is it growing? Give me some description of what we're coping with here.
Sure. I think it's been a problem that has existed. However, in my opinion, I think it's a problem that's existed behind the scenes for many, many years. And as homelessness in general has increased in our country, but definitely here in the state of Maine and here in Aroostook County, youth homelessness needed its own voice. And I'm happy to say that there have been people in our community that have been stepping up to try to help this issue, individuals, families, to support in youth that have been experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness. I've heard many stories from parents who had a child that was a friend of their child's on a soccer team, and they heard about some experiences, them experiencing homelessness or couch surfing, and so it took them in. And so those are the stories that we don't hear about because, you know, they're the problems that have been addressed through our community members. However, as the years have gone on and the population of youth experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness is growing, then it's grown to a point where the community needs services to step up and community voices to step up and to support these youth, whether it's from educational standpoint, a family standpoint, and from where we are, a housing standpoint.
How sad is this that there are kids who just have no place to go, who are just adrift? Not only do they not have a shelter over their heads, but they don't have anybody to look after them or parent them.
Yes, it's a serious problem, and we're trying to be a part of the solution because this is a community effort across the board addressing youth homelessness.
So, Blake, tell me about who these kids are. I mean, what ages, gender, how do we characterize the kids that are showing up at the shelter?
That's a great question. The kids, we have a variety of kids coming to our shelter in our transitional living program from all kinds of different backgrounds. Boys, girls, we have individuals, youth identifying the LGBTQ community. And our age ranges for what we support for our transitional living program, for example, is 16 to 21. And for our emergency shelter, where we support youth ages 10 to 17. So far, the ages that we've primarily worked with in our emergency shelter have right around been 15 all the way up to 17 have been the ages that we predominantly have seen. We have had the youngest we've seen in our shelter was 13. So that's kind of the demographic that we're working with.
Your traditional mission has been mental health. Project involves kind of emergency shelter. Do you also offer mental health therapy and treatment for these kids, or is it strictly a roof over their heads?
So the program in and of itself is strictly housing. We used to do residential services for youth experience, you know, needing behavioral supports. And we actually ended that service in order to start and house homeless youth. And so the program in and of itself is focusing on basic needs, safety, housing, food, and developing basic life skills. When youth come to us needing mental health services or substance use services, we do our very best to connect them with mental health services. That's an ongoing project. That's an ongoing concern, is that how we can incorporate more mental health services in the program. But the first immediate need of the program is meeting basic needs. Safety, food, shelter is where we start with a youth that we work with.
Well, I with a group of educators earlier this week, and apparently kids not going to school is a rising problem. They're just sort of dropping out. And it sounds like that might be part of this situation as well.
Yes, we encounter many youth who come to find out because of the what's brought them to experiencing homelessness has shown up beforehand in the school system, where maybe lack of attendance, or, you know, you see a decline in their grades or disengagement with their education, which makes sense because when your basic needs aren't being met through safety, food, and shelter, then it's hard to focus on aspiring to learn and be educated at school.
Well, it's now, where are you located? Are you in Holton or further north?
We're further north. Our shelter and transitional living program are on 14 Main Street in Mars Hill.
Okay, so now, talk about the grant that brought us here, the CDS grant that Northern Lighthouse has just received. What's it going to go for, and is it going to be helpful?
It's gonna be a tremendous help. It's gonna have a massive impact to not only Aroostook County but to the state of Maine in and of itself. So I'll start with the project. The project in the state of Maine, there is limited funding options to support a shelters and transitional living programs. So we actually, our project was started through a federal grant that funded like the startup of the shelter and transitional living program through the Family Youth Services Bureau. And they provide a small sum of $200,000 to launch the program. And because of how the state of Maine is structured, the state of Maine supports shelters and transitional living programs through a contracts or an RFP process to become part of the contract. And when we entered this field of addressing youth homelessness, the contracts had already been awarded to the other agencies in the state of Maine who were currently had existing programs. So we are not yet a part of the contract because the RFPs are closed for another couple of years.
So you may have heard what I was talking with Tony Ronzio about. This is money that you really wouldn't have had any, there wasn't anywhere to go for this money.
Exactly. That's why it's such a tremendous support for us, because the funding in and of itself will help with our gap, because we have a gap funding. We have a total operating budget to make this possible, which we get part of it from the Family Youth Services Bureau. We're collecting private grants and donations as much as we can, but this really was a huge lifesaver for us for the program, because not only is it going to help fill part of our gap for running the program, but it's also going to help fund additional staff and equipment, as well as food. And we're going to be adding a vehicle to the program as well. We have two vans that we utilize for the program. And as we know, vehicles wear out over time. And we have youth that we're serving who need to go places, who need to be transported for educational purposes and appointments.
What do you anticipate as a daily census? How many kids are we talking about?
Well, currently, as of today, we have one young individual in our emergency shelter, and we have five individuals in our transitional living program. And we have one bed that opened in the transitional living program that we're actually currently, we've interviewed three people so far, and we have a few more interviews of people interviewing to referring to take that open slot. So the need is there. The need is definitely there.
Just literally have no place else to go.
Correct.
And do you work with the schools as well?
We work with as much of the community as we possibly can. We coordinate with the schools, a variety of schools. Our local school has been supportive in helping us get, if a youth comes from out of Mars Hill, who does live in Mars Hill and comes to us, we have enrolled individuals in the Mars Hill school system, as well as supporting youth working with their existing school programs through televideo means and a home-based schooling option.
Well, let me broaden the conversation a little bit, because as I talk to people around the state, one of the problems that comes up is the lack of mental health professionals. We just don't have the people, the counselors, therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists. We don't have the people to deal with particularly this, I almost would call it an epidemic of behavioral health, mental health issues, and oftentimes arising out of the pandemic. For these young people that were isolated for a couple of years, how are you doing getting staff? Is this a challenge up there as it is most places?
It is a huge challenge. Finding therapists is extremely difficult. We have a good team of therapists. We're very fortunate to have them, but our wait lists for mental health services specifically are so long, we need more therapists, and we're constantly recruiting to find more therapists because the need in our communities and across the state of Maine is growing drastically.
Well, and the problem with a wait list on someone who's in a mental health or a substance abuse crisis is a wait list could be a death sentence.
Absolutely. It's a much needed service. And we are trying to be creative as an agency to how we can recruit and find people. We're promoting people and encouraging people. If it's something that's a career path they want to seek, you know, starting at the base level of saying somebody's interested in becoming a therapist, we're like, you know, we're encouraging them to help them find resources, because eventually our hope is that when they go to school, that getting them as an intern into our organization and then eventually as a licensed professional, you know, we're having to start from the ground up. And, even some of our own staff, we have an administrator currently who has decided he really wants to take a more direct approach to tackling the mental health issue in our community. So he's actually just in the process of finishing up his education to become a therapist, and will be staying on with us, and we'll be adding into our ranks as a therapist by next year.
Do you use telehealth at all for counseling? That's been successful in many parts of the state. And interestingly, people seem comfortable talking to a screen, and sometimes more comfortable than an in-person meeting. And plus, you don't have to have the stigma of sitting in an office with other people waiting for a behavioral health consultation.
Absolutely. Telehealth has been amazing for us. If anything positive came out of COVID, it would be our new understanding of televideo services and how we can access people rurally. We did it prior to COVID a little bit, but when COVID hit, we wanted to be successful, and we wanted to make sure we would continue to meet the needs in our community. So we transitioned quickly to all telehealth. We do offer in-person services currently at our Prescott location, but in our Bangor location, but we have clinicians seeing people across the state of Maine, not only in Aroostook County, but our clinicians based here in Aroostook County are seeing people across the state who have these needs.
Well, as you know, there were emergency regulations passed during COVID that facilitated telehealth and how it would be billed and that kind of thing. Many of those regulations are expiring or have expired. Something I've been working on is keeping them in place. I mean, we're not in COVID anymore, but as you say, we learned from COVID how important this tool is, and we shouldn't just go back and say, well, now we don't have to do this anymore, because it's very effective and cost effective for the whole system.
It's extremely effective. I'm really happy to hear you say that you're still working on that, because I will say this, as a provider and us needing to continually evolve our practices to meet the needs of our community, there are individuals across the state of Maine now, because of ours and other agencies like us, use of telehealth, they're getting access to therapy that they otherwise wouldn't have. We have individuals from the Allegash, a very remote part of Aroostook County, who get an opportunity to access therapy. And we have individuals in the southern part of the state, in very rural parts, who have hour or two drive to get to any type of provider to get individual therapy. Now they can do it from the comfort and the safety of their own home. Accessing individuals with severe medical needs is now possible way more easier through televideo services. So it's definitely something that we need to continue to focus on and continue to develop because our community needs it.
Well, now you told me about the nature of these young people, and do you see this as a growing problem, or is it something we're going to be able to solve? Or I just worry that between kids dropping out of school and homeless, and they're going to be adrift, and it's hard to know what's going to become of them. At the same time, we need these young people to later on, when they're 18 or 20, to be ready to go into the workforce.
Yes. So it's a growing problem, but I think the more we as a community step up to be a part of the solution and to brainstorm with these youth and together as a community to address these issues, going back to the telehealth, that's part of the solution, providing mental health services that might support a family staying unified together. And in the event that a youth becomes homeless, that we offer them those supports, as well as keeping them engaged with a community. So one of the issues that we ran into that really, really lit a fire for us to do this program was we were hearing about youth in Aroostook County not having an option when they were struggling with homelessness, and they were having to go to Bangor, which is two and a half, three hours north, south of us, New Beginnings in Lewiston or Preble Street in Portland. So we had Aroostook County youth leaving their community.
Those programs in Bangor, Lewiston, and Portland are overwhelmed by people coming from around the state. So to the extent you can provide these services closer to home, that's better for the kids and better for the community, and also take some pressure off of those other communities.
Absolutely. Our goal was to keep Aroostook County kids in Aroostook County, giving them a chance to stay connected with their community, with their friends and natural supports. I will also say that since we've opened our program, we've actually partnered with the other programs downstate. And we've actually had youth from the southern part of the state come up to Arusa County to access our services because there were no other services available, or maybe there were some conflicts of the other services and they had no other options.
Or because Arusa County is a really cool place.
And that as well. One story that blew my mind when our staff told me about it, we had a young person traveled from the Waterville area, had his bike when he got here, and came to Arusa County for one purpose or another. And in the end, it didn't work out for whatever reason. He came up here and ended up at our program. So when we were talking with him, you know, where did you come from? He's like, well, I'm from Waterville. I'm like, how'd you get up here? Through means of his bike, and I don't know if he hitchhiked, but his bike was a huge part of his journey up here.
Wow, that's a long ride.
Yeah.
Well, Blake, thank you for what you're doing, and you're making a difference one person at a time in a very serious situation. You're literally saving lives. I'm delighted that we were able to help out with this the funding for this project. And the other thing is that we're hoping that these projects will prove themselves so that we can keep going. And in a sense, you've heard me talking to Tony about pilot projects, and you're always working to try to find better ways to deliver these services. But now, one final question.
Yeah.
What level of cooperation do you have from the communities? Are you supported emotionally, financially by the towns up there? Do they realize the importance of the service you're providing?
Educating our community has been an ongoing process. We have had some local church communities who have reached out to provide us some funding or donations. Our local town officials have been very supportive of our program, and some of our schools that we've interacted with are supportive of the program. But I will tell you, one continual thing that we are working on is educating the community on the seriousness of youth homelessness and what we're trying to do, and connecting with as many community partners so we can provide these youth with an opportunity to build skills, enter the workforce, continue with their education. Some of the main points of our program is to, aside from safety, food, and having a warm place to sleep, we want to engage them in their education. We want to engage them with their community, volunteering, and prepare them for the workforce. Like currently, we have three youth who have college acceptance letters for the fall, which we're really excited about.
That's
we
fair.
Have one youth who has left the program and gone on to college. And, you know, we have eight youth in our program since we started who we've been able to engage them with employment, you know, getting jobs. So I think community education is huge because that's what helps break down barriers. You know, like one barrier we run into sometimes is people needing to understand that the Maine has statutes for unaccompanied minors. Because these youth come into our program and they don't have parents that are involved or not willing to be involved, but they still need medical care. They still need dental. They still need to go to school. They still need services and treatments. And for a youth trying to get a job who may not have come with their birth certificate or their driver's license, we work with these youth to obtain their birth certificates and their driver's licenses or their IDs and social security numbers so that way they can enter the workforce. And we've had challenges obtaining those, but we've been successful in getting them, as well as trying to, even as simple as getting a bank account to have a direct deposit from your employer. We've had to work with some local banks to really explain our situation and for them to really be creative in how they can support a youth opening a bank account on their own so that way they can have a direct deposit from their employer.
Well, Blake, you have no idea what it means to me to hear what you're doing, because, you know, we're down in Washington and we're voting and pushing paper, and to hear about and come to understand the reality on the ground of what these programs can and are doing is it means so much. And I want to thank you personally for the work that you're doing and all the people on the staff. And I was thinking as we were talking, Northern Lighthouse, that's a great image. A lighthouse is something that protects people from crashes, from disaster. And that's what you're doing. You're literally saving lives and changing lives. So Blake Hatt at the Northern Lighthouse, thank you for what you're doing. Thanks for the work on this CDS grant. I'm delighted we were able to pull it off, and look forward to hearing from you as to how it's going.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate this. And I can honestly say to you and your team, as well as your listeners, that this funding is affecting the future, and it is helping to create more resilience in our community.
That's great. Thank you, Blake. And thank you for joining us on Inside Maine. Today, we've been talking about the CDS program, Congressionally Directed Spending, which is bringing federal funds to small towns and communities throughout the state, nonprofits and communities, towns, the state, to make a difference in Maine people's lives. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being with us. If you want to learn more about this program, you can go to my website, king.senate.gov, and you can get all the background on all the projects. Thanks again for being with us. See you next time. This is Angus King on Inside Maine.